from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, are you avoiding beef because of its association with heart disease and other health problems? Or maybe you're concerned about the toll it takes on the environment. Author Nicolette Hahn-Nyman says nearly everything we think we know about the negative effects of meat production is wrong. And what's more, cattle are actually essential to the health and restoration of the planet. We talk with a vegetarian environmental lawyer turned cattle rancher about her new book, Defending Beef, right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. In the 1980s, Nicolette Hahn-Nyman says she adopted the belief that no genuine environmentalist or humanitarian could eat beef. But when she was hired as an environmental lawyer by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and was forced to confront the nuances of meat production, she says her view changed. And by the time well-known cattle rancher Bill Nyman proposed to her, she said she'd abandoned her simplistic negative view of both ranching and beef. Hahn-Nyman writes about why she now believes meat production can actually save the planet in her new book, Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. Nicolette Hahn-Nyman, welcome to Forum.
Oh, thank you. It's really my pleasure to be here.
And congratulations on the book. So let's just get right to it. I mean, beef production has been singled out as a major contributor to climate change because cattle emit methane. But you've actually said this is a bit of a myth.
Well, there certainly is methane that comes from ruminant animals. So it's not that there's no truth to the allegation. But the problem is it's been dramatically overblown. And so, first of all, it's important to note that the official U.S. EPA figures for how much cattle contribute to global warming is about 2%. In fact, that's for all ruminant animals. So that includes goats and bison as well. So that 2% figure is very important to keep in mind in these conversations. Secondly, that figure does not take into account the possible very positive benefits that people are increasingly believe can come from well-managed grazing, which can sequester massive amounts of carbon. In fact, it's estimated by the Union of Concerned Scientists and others who have looked at this issue that there might be the possibility of sequestering enough carbon that it would almost entirely offset all of the global warming impact of cattle.
So explain that. How could we sequester carbon related to cattle and cattle ranching?
Well, there is already some of that happening. It's already happening. But the idea is that you could improve it by improving grazing practices. Because essentially, this is really kind of an emerging science, but it's been determined that since 1850, about 10% of all the carbon that's been lost to the atmosphere actually comes from the soils. And so the soils are now being looked at as probably the most important way to mitigate climate change, certainly for agriculture anyways. And because there's been so much carbon lost from the soils, they actually could act kind of as a sink, as a sponge. They could take up a lot of carbon. They're sort of missing a lot of carbon right now. And the most promising way to do that is in grasslands. And there are a lot of different reasons for that. I can describe it in as much detail as you like. But essentially, grazing animals foster that process. And especially when they're really well managed, there's a lot of carbon that goes into the soils and stays in the soils. And the fact that grazing lands are undisturbed areas with very dense vegetative cover is a really important part of the story.
So in reading your book, I understood that basically when cattle are trampling on the grass and grazing on the grass, they allow grasslands to flourish. So, you know, when they're grazing, they're allowing it to, like, sort of a lawnmower, how it allows more lush grasses to grow. And then when they're trampling on the grass, how does that help?
Well, there are lots of what are referred to by scientists as beneficial disturbances. So we tend to think of grazing animals, especially cattle, because they're such big, heavy animals, we tend to think of their impacts on the land as negative. But what increasingly, there's sort of an increasing belief within a lot of the scientific and agricultural community that the disturbances that cattle cause in their grazing are actually beneficial to as long as they're managed in such a way that they're mimicking the wild animals that once covered the globe, the wild grazing and predatory animals that once covered the globe. So the reason that is not totally understood, why this happens in terms of the increased carbon sequestration is not totally understood. But fundamentally, it goes like this. The clipping by the mouths is similar to pruning you would do in your garden. It stimulates plant growth and it removes dead vegetation. The trampling is beneficial because the hooves push the seeds into the ground, which helps germination. And they also push the plant matter into the soils, which helps the whole carbon cycling process because basically the soils can then be fed by that vegetative, the plant matter, the soil organic matter, basically. And also just the whole process of the animals eating the vegetation and then the manure coming out of the ground is very helpful in terms of the nutrient cycling. So there are multiple different forms of impacts and no one is quite sure, you know, what impact is more important than the other. But increasingly, there's a body of science showing that grazed areas are more densely covered in vegetation and have a greater diversity of plant species and a greater diversity within the soil. So these are all very important factors.
And so you're essentially saying that because flourishing grasslands, as well as you were saying earlier, actually suck carbon from the atmosphere, they mitigate the methane that could be released from the cows that causes global warming or climate change.
Right. Because when you're talking about global warming, there are three major gases, carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide. And increasingly, scientists are talking about these in carbon equivalent terms. So the primary concern with ruminant animals is the methane emissions. But when you talk about it in terms of its global warming impact, it's usually sort of put in a carbon equivalent term. And that 2% I was talking about, which is what's attributed to all ruminant animals, is for all of the types of global warming impact that they have in the United States.
So if grassland's so beneficial, why did we veer so sharply away from grass?
Well, there are a number of reasons that that happened historically, but the main reason was probably because after World War II, there were a lot of munitions plants in the United States, which essentially would have just simply gone idle. They had been used to create bombs, and they were fairly easily converted to making fertilizer and other agricultural chemicals. Chemical fertilizers had actually been discovered more than 100 years before that, but they were not in common usage. Then suddenly there were all these facilities available to produce it. And I talked about in my first book, Righteous Pork Chop, how this dramatically increased right after World War II. There was a very dramatic increase in the fertilizer usage and other agricultural chemical usage. And so essentially grass had always played that role. It had provided fertility to the ground because when you use grass as a cover crop, it helps to keep pests down, it helps to rebuild soils and fertility, and it creates an opportunity for grazing animals to be on the ground as a part of a multi-crop rotation. All of those functions that were once carried out by grass in our agricultural system became carried out by chemicals after World War II. So it was a dramatic shift. I'm arguing we need to return to a grass-based agricultural system.
You know, let me lob another argument against bee projection, and that is that it's been singled out as a heavy user of water, if not a polluter of water.
Right. Yeah. And water is really kind of my special expertise because I was an environmental lawyer for the National Wildlife Federation, and I was an environmental lawyer for Bobby Kennedy Jr.'s organization, Waterkeeper. And my primary focus in those years was water. Protecting water both in terms of quantity and quality. And those are both concerns when you're talking about agriculture. So basically, when you're talking about the quantity, that especially tends to get talked about with beef production. The most important thing to note is that the numbers that one typically hears are almost always based on worst-case scenarios. And so University of California at Davis did a very thorough analysis of water usage in beef production a few years ago. And what they calculated is what it would take to produce a typical pound of beef. And this was actually just even feedlot beef, which is more water-intensive. And they found that a pound of beef is only slightly more water intensive than a typical pound of rice. So I think that's a very important starting point in the conversation. And then in terms of water usage and quantity issues, again, It's really important to note that the most beneficial land use in terms of keeping water in the ground, in the soils, in the ecosystems, is when you have dense vegetative covering on the land, such as you have in a typical grazing operation. The other side of the water question is water quality. And I talk a lot about that in the book, how grazing is beneficial because it's using densely vegetated land to produce food in a way that does not cause us to have to plow. And whenever you plow, that's very damaging to water quality. It potentially is. It's almost always very damaging to water quality, pollution. And so well-managed grazing operations, a lot of research has shown, are actually the best usage of land in terms of protecting water quality, according to a lot of research.
So you're really making this distinction between sustainable cattle ranching or sustainable meat production processes and what also exists out there, which is industrial agriculture.
That's true. Absolutely. And my book is really arguing that we need to, it's both a critique and a defense of beef, because there's quite a bit in the current practices that is not being done well or being done in the best way. So I'm hoping actually a lot of people within the beef industry and a lot of cattle ranchers will read it. And so far that it seems to be happening, because I make a lot of suggestions about how a lot of arguments about how we should be improving what we're doing in terms of raising beef. But I forgot your question. I'm sorry.
Well, no, I just that you are. It's not so much that you're defending the meat industry as a whole.
Right. That's true. So what I was going to say is feedlot beef is there are many problems with feedlots, especially when you get into large scale feedlots. But the thing I wanted to note, I know where I was heading with that, is that all cattle in the United States are on grass for much of their lives. All of the mother cows, which is about 25 million cattle in the United States, all of the bulls, all of the calves are on grass. So I'm also arguing, I'm not strictly talking about that 5% of beef production that is totally grass-fed. I'm talking about the entire industry when the animals are on grass, that the grazing practices need to be improved. And if they are, we'll see huge ecological benefits. And I'm also arguing that we need to move more and more towards grass-based. So, yes.
And you also are arguing that that eating animals is beneficial to your health and as well as the land.
Right. Well, obviously there are a number of people in the world who choose not to eat animals. And I think that's obviously a very respectable choice. I've been making that choice myself for many years. I'm still a vegetarian. I have been for almost 30 years. I don't believe people must eat meat, but I do think that for people who are omnivorous, people who don't have any, you know, moral or ethical qualms about eating meat, that beef is a good choice. And I especially believe, I was actually really surprised when I looked very deeply at this issue, how nutritious beef is, because if you just look at a nutritional label, you only get a little bit of the picture. Because when it comes to just about every major nutrient, whether you're talking about protein, zinc, iron, whatever it is, in beef, it's actually in the optimal form as far as your body's ability to assimilate it. So it's a highly nutritious food. And I argue in quite a bit of detail that the saturated fat danger has been very misunderstood. And in fact, I don't really believe that's a problem at all. But even if you believe that, you can find lean beef, and it's a very nutritionally dense food that I think people should have as part of their diets if they're omnivorous.
And a couple of months ago, we actually had Nina Teicholz on about her book, The Big Fat Surprise, which also tried to debunk all the idea that red meat causes heart attacks and various other, you know, ill health effects.
Yes.
Okay, so if it's so ideal, so great to a healthy diet, why do you continue to be a vegetarian?
Well, that's a question that a lot of people have asked me, but it's interesting. I've gotten the question from a number of people who also have sort of complex food choices that they've made in their diet. And so they're just sort of curious why I've, you know, taken this path that seems to be parallel to their own. I think individual dietary choices are very complex. You know, I meet people all the time that eat this but don't eat that, and it doesn't seem to make sense. The only thing I can say about it is I grew up spending a lot of time outdoors. For me, it's always been very natural and very normal that humans, as part of the natural cycles of the world and as part of the animal world, would eat other animals. That said, and when I made my own choice to stop eating meat, I really did it primarily based on my belief that to be a good environmental citizen, you really had to stop eating meat. And I also believed that idea that saturated fat was bad for you, and so therefore you shouldn't eat beef, and especially beef, and other meat. And then over the last, especially the last 14 years, since I started working on livestock-related issues, my views have shifted pretty dramatically on those issues.
So now
So from a philosophical standpoint, you know, and from a sort of just a intellectual standpoint, I totally buy into the idea that meat is healthy food and can be very ecologically raised. But I've been not eating meat for so long. I mean, it's literally been, I think it's like 28 years now. And I'm just very comfortable in my diet. I do have two young sons, and I feed them meat because it's mostly the meat that we raise ourselves. But I think it's a really important part of a healthy diet, and very valuable for people who choose to eat it, and especially for children.
We're talking with Nicolette Hahn-Nyman about her new book, Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production, where she challenges the notion that meat production is bad for the environment and our health. Give us a call and join the discussion at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. You know, I also thought it was interesting that you put forward the idea that vegetarianism does not necessarily reduce your carbon footprint.
Yeah, I really do believe that. That's something we hear again and again, and I just think that's so oversimplified, because all food production has quite dramatic ecological effects, including climate change effects. I wrote an op-ed for the New York Times about this a few years ago called The Carnivore's Dilemma. And basically, when you look at the whole food sector, there are many portions of it that contribute to climate change. There's the transport portion of it. There's the storage. There's the preparation. You know, everything basically from when it goes into the ground, if it's a seed, to when you consume it, there are many different stages. And a lot of that is part of the whole climate change picture. What happens on farm is actually a relatively small portion of that. But all parts of that affect climate change, regardless of what type of food it is. So there's some research that was done in Sweden on this that show that just a carrot, for example, would have a differing impact, a global warming impact, by a factor of 10, depending on how it was raised. So, you know, I think actually eating from foods that are in season, from your region, trying to eat foods that are, you know, not transported a long ways, obviously, or stored for a long period of time, or highly processed, I think those are probably things that are equally as important. So I think those are things to take into consideration when you're choosing what to eat.
And let's go to some of your calls. Let's go to Mary in Mountain View. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I would like to say that, you know, the world's population is growing very rapidly, and we're going to have 10 billion people by the year 2100. And according to a lot of authors I have read, we could feed the whole world on plants and have lots of land left over. For example, Bruce Babcock, who is an economics professor at Iowa State University, says our ability to supply the world with vegetables is virtually unlimited. We would have more land available for the 10 billion people than they would know what to do with. In order to supply food for everybody, I think we need to be setting the example of eating less meat and more plants. The third world is looking to us as an example, and since we eat more meat than they do, as they become more profitable, they are wanting to eat more meat, which is causing them a lot of health problems. They're now having heart disease, which they never had before. They're now having diabetes and cancer. And, you know, scaling up this idea of the free-range cows, we just don't have enough space for it. If we grew plants for everybody, we would have enough food and lots of land left over where we could let the wildlife take over, and we could have the right kind of hooved animals, using their hoof action. Animals would die and decompose into the soil naturally, and and then again be, you know, the decomposing animals would be stomped into the soil, instead of people trying to mimic nature and control nature with electric fences. You know, when these systems are...
Mary, thanks. Let me just give Nicolette a chance to respond to your, I think your central question is just about this question of also space for cows to graze.
Yes. Well, actually, the caller cited many of the arguments that one hears very commonly, and I do address all of those issues in the book. Just to go through a few of the points. First of all, Americans are eating substantially less red meat. The total red meat consumption in the U.S. is down by about 18% over the last few decades, and beef consumption is down about 22% over the last few decades. So that is already happening. But when you talk about the total world food system, it's also very, very important to note that in the United States, about 85% of cattle grazing is taking place on land that cannot be used for crop production, and that's about the same figure for the world. So you're really not, when you're raising cattle on grass, you're not taking food away from the food system. That's a, and also it's, I kind of go through, again, I go through this in a lot of detail in defending beef, but the production of food is really not the primary problem in our food system. There's a lot of evidence. There's tons of stuff that's been written about this showing that we're producing far more calories in the world today than we need to feed the population. Production is not the problem. It's really about sustainability and sustainable practices. And I think that the most ecologically sustainable food system will definitely involve grazing animals.
So, you know, one of the things that you talked about was also that about the significant erosion that comes from cropland. Do you want to say a little bit about that as well?
Yeah.
Just because this caller does bring up the, right. You know, you vegetables and growing vegetables.
Right. Well, all crop production, nearly all of it, is done using the plow. And I have a quote from Wes Jackson, who's probably one of the greatest agricultural thinkers in the world. And he wrote this wonderful book called New Roots for Agriculture, where he talks about, you know, what has happened from agriculture to the globe over, you know, the course of human history in the 12,000 years we've been practicing agriculture. And he actually says the plow is the single greatest damaging thing that has happened to the globe. He also says that a very poorly managed cattle ranch will have a much better environmental impact than a typical crop farm. It's really important for people to understand that when they're juxtaposing crop production against grazing animal production. But basically, you're basically scraping the earth and you're ripping apart the community that is below ground, the whole microscopic community and the soil organisms and all of the roots of the plants. That's why grazing land, which remains unplowed, is actually ecologically optimal. And that's why I keep saying it's such an important part of the food system.
We're talking with Nicolette Hahn-Nyman about her new book, Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. Her previous book was Righteous Pork Chop, Finding a Life and Good Food Beyond Factory Farms. Give us a call and join the discussion at 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. And we'll definitely get to more of your calls and emails. We're getting quite a few of them. From our listeners after the break. I'm Mina Kim. Do stay with us. We're talking with Nicolette Hahn-Nyman about her new book, Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production, where she challenges the notion that meat production is bad for the environment and our health. Let's hear what our listeners have to say. Richard in San Francisco. Hi, Richard.
Yes, I know that I raised my children on a farm in northern Maine, and as a state, we always borrowed ideas from Vermont. I know we're talking about meat production, but cattle also do produce milk as a protein. The models that Vermont has adopted are where the manure is captured and then the methane harvested and used to power microturbines. This not only allows the farmer to operate without paying for electricity, but there's also, because of the volume, they can decentralize different farms in the area or housing as well and provide a whole separate grid that is basically carbon-free. There's some talk about this process being used in feedlots that have to change the manner because manure cows, dairy cows tend to have a wetter manure than beef cattle. But these dairy cows are also grazed every day. So they're not only helping by grazing, they're also providing energy to the farmers and the surrounding community.
Richard, thanks. Andrea tweets, production of 1 calorie of animal protein requires 10 times the fossil fuel input as a calorie of plant protein. And she cites the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Do you want to respond to that?
Well, I talk about all these issues in the book. Basically, you know, I go back again to the point that you cannot raise food on grasslands without disturbing that grasslands unless you have grazing animals. And the world right now is about 40% grasslands. The U.S. is a very high percentage grasslands as well. And that's a good thing. Grasslands are the single largest solar collector that the world has, and they present by far the largest opportunity for carbon sequestration. So we really want to have those grasslands. They're also the optimal system for protecting both soils and water. So I just really reject this calorie-to-calorie comparison because it really doesn't make any sense when you look at the world food system today and how it actually functions.
Andrea writes also, ridiculous. Science has proven animal agriculture is very destructive to the environment, plus so much suffering, even with sustainable meat. Wrong! Exclamation mark. A listener asks, grass-fed beef is only sustainable on a small scale, and that would mean people would have to cut back on how much meat they ate. Only the rich could afford to eat this way, unfortunately. What do you say to people who say, grass-fed meat, I'd like to do it, but it's extremely expensive?
Well, that's another misperception. I mean, the world over, the vast majority of cattle are actually on grass. The feedlot system is prevalent in the United States and some other westernized countries, and they also exist in Brazil. But basically, the vast majority of the world's cattle already are on grass. And as I mentioned earlier, even in the United States, most cattle spend either all or a large portion of their lives on grass. So what I'm arguing is we need to improve the management on those grasslands, and we need to move cattle more toward grass. The Savory Institute, which is doing work the world over on improving grazing practices, has actually done an analysis that shows that in the United States, if you used optimal grazing methods, there would be more than enough grasslands available to produce all the beef that is produced today. In fact, they found that there's about a 30% surplus of land. So that's a typical perception as well, but it's simply not true.
That said, though, when you're doing a cost comparison now, right, you do find that it's much more expensive.
It is more expensive, and a lot of that has to do simply with the way that food policy coming out of Washington subsidizes agriculture. So it's not logical that raising cattle on grass would cost more than raising them fed grains that are grown elsewhere and transported. But because of the way the modern agricultural policy in the United States exists, basically grains are fairly heavily subsidized in a number of different ways, and that makes it cheaper. We need to shift agricultural policy. And in the meantime, I think, you know, consumers can be very helpful in driving the trend towards grass-fed beef by seeking it out.
A listener writes, I think writing a book on beef is a very lucrative concept in this day and age where local food and natural raised beef is hip. I have to question the sincerity of your guest raising animals for slaughter as a livelihood and touting vegetarianism is like a drug dealer promoting sobriety. I recommend the listeners to look up a documentary called Cowspiracy. It sheds the light on the unsustainability of the meat industry and the political and economic ties to environmentalists who are unable to accept and admit that any kind of meat production is not sustainable on this planet. You know, what's your response to the idea, Nicolette Hahn-Nyman, that, well, of course, you're going to trumpet grass-fed meat. You have an economic interest in this. That's the product that you and your husband, Bill Nyman, sell.
Well, that actually has been raised by actually pretty much the vegan community again and again. I can only say this. First of all, if you look at my resume, you'll know that I spent many years working on environmental causes before I had any connection to agriculture. And I spent 3 years working full-time as a lawyer for environmental organizations and 2 years working full-time on issues related to the livestock industry. This is something I've been working on for 14 years. I think my involvement, my firsthand involvement on a ranch is actually essential to understanding this issue. So I think I bring a diversity of cases, perspectives to the issue. And I think that really makes my argument more interesting and more credible because I've been doing this stuff firsthand in addition to all the research that I've done.
And let's go to more of your calls. Let's go to Chris in Oakland. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how you doing? My question begins with, my question is in two part. The first part is, it seems like we're beginning this level of analysis at sort of with the premise that like that beef and sort of meat production is the place to begin. And that's where we should start. Where that seems like an incredibly inefficient way to go about this. And for example, why are we beginning the analysis there when we could be talking about something else? For example, why are we talking about some sort of technological innovation that would completely supplant the idea of meat production in the first place? And if we're going to talk about that, I mean, that would also address other issues such as, you know, the ethical concerns that I don't think the caller's really addressed here, and we would be able to avoid that. Why are we beginning the debate there?
So you're saying that even as a starting point, beef is not a place that we should look to in terms of sustainability?
Yeah, or why are we looking there? And it seems like an inefficient way to do that. Why aren't we looking someplace else or looking at other alternative methods? And why are we sort of starting with beef or animal or meat production as the beginning of this analysis?
All right. Well, thanks for that perspective. Nicolette, did you want to respond?
Yeah. I mean, I actually really do encourage that caller who, you know, seemed to be very thoughtful and was really thinking about these issues carefully to look at my book. I'm not assuming that we have to have grazing animals and therefore we should figure out how to make them sustainable. I'm looking at ecosystems and saying, how do we make ecosystems function? And actually, increasingly, there's more and more belief within the scientific community that the grazing animals, the large animals that once covered the globe that have disappeared in modern history, actually for about the last several thousand years, they've been gone. When you don't have those animals, you do not have properly functioning ecosystems. So we actually need those animals. It's not just a matter of trying to mitigate the damage. They're essential.
Chris, thanks for the call. Let's go to Maria in Sacramento. Hi, Maria.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. My belief is that one of the most important ways to mitigate climate change and promote biodiversity is to conserve our forests. And one of my anxieties about eating beef is that so much forest is being cleared to create cattle ranches. So, for example, forests in the Amazon, but also closer to home, the redwood forest in Northern California along the coast. So I was just wondering how you approach that idea that maybe if more of the world's population ate more beef, more forests would inevitably be cleared.
Maria, thanks.
Well, first of all, it's imperative to understand I do not advocate that people eat more beef. I'm arguing that having some beef in the food system is nutritionally beneficial and having some cattle on the land is ecologically beneficial. I talk very specifically in my book about the deforestation issue. There is deforestation happening in Latin America, but it is totally unconnected to American beef consumption. There's the vast majority of beef in the United States that Americans are consuming today is totally domestically produced. Of the about 16% that is imported, about 80% of that comes from either Canada, Mexico, or Australia. The remaining 2 to 3% of the beef that comes from all other countries in the world combined includes, you know, a tiny portion of that would come from the countries where there's any active deforestation. The United States is not experiencing deforestation. In fact, in the past 25 years, the total forested acres in the United States has dramatically increased. In fact, in the history of the United States, there's never been any major clearing of forests for the purpose of cattle grazing. It's been done for agriculture, for crop production, and then those lands sometimes become grazing areas. But there is absolutely no significant history in the United States of forest clearing for grazing. It simply never happened.
And thanks so much, Maria, for the call. We're getting a lot of also online comments, cool food tweets, making a distinction between sustainable meat production and concentrated animal feeding operations. CFAO, yes, we should be moving more to grass-fed system. Another listener asks, please ask your guest if the comparison between water required for a pound of beef being equivalent to water for a pound of rice is misleading. Rice is the most water-intensive agriculture.
No, that's exactly my point, is that there are lots of water-intensive foods in our very common, you know, in our cupboards. They include coffee, chocolate, rice, sugar, avocados, walnuts, almonds. My point isn't that beef is not water intensive. My point is that there are many water intensive foods, and that alone is not reason to completely banish, you know, beef from our plates.
Could Nicolette please clarify something for listeners? Another listener asks, some may not realize that you and your husband are no longer affiliated with Nyman Ranch. In the past, Bill Nyman expressed concern over some of Nyman Ranch's practices. Do you still have concerns about their husbandry issues and inability to confirm the source of some of Nyman's products?
Well, we left the Nyman Ranch company, and we have a new company called BN Ranch, and it is totally grass-fed beef, and we also raise heritage turkeys.
Another listener asks, do grass-fed cows emit as much methane as corn-fed cows?
Well, there's a lot of debate about that, actually, and I actually did not specifically address that question in my book. I was just talking with a scientist by the name of Doug Gurian-Sherman, who used to be – we had about an hour-long phone conversation a couple of days ago, and we were talking about the fact that – and he's the author of a report that the Union of Concerned Scientists did on this very issue. And he and I were talking about the fact that the science is so unsettled on that point that it's not very productive to take a stance on it. Essentially, the other issues I talked about earlier in terms of the carbon sequestration, and there are also very good studies being done all over the world about how to mitigate methane from ruminant animals, and there are various things that have been shown to reduce methane production by as much as 30%. We can definitely bring down the methane. I think that's a more productive way to look at the issue.
Another listener says, please have your guest discuss the fact that not all beef and other meat is raised sustainably, and it will be a very long time indeed before it ever approaches the way she raises her meat. I agree that eating some meat, but in great moderation, small and infrequent portions, is fine as part of a varied healthy diet. But she and the woman who you had on a few months ago touting the benefits of meat-based fat have to make sure that their pitches include the infrequency and moderation essentials. Otherwise, we really will perpetuate the intensive water, energy, grain, greenhouse gas, antibiotics, hormones, and other environmental and health costs of meat rather than the potential benefits. I mean, I think this listener makes a point. I mean, you know, as you've said, the problems are with cows that are raised and fed and injected with hormones and in way and transported long distances in ways that you don't agree with. But there are obstacles to moving to grass-based farming, and I imagine it's not necessarily something that's going to happen terribly soon. So I wonder how you balance the message of, you know, eating that meat production, sustainable meat production is good.
And well, I do. You know, in my first book, Righteous Pork Chop, I specifically said, eat less meat, eat better meat. And I've always tried to pair those two messages. But I really believe it's important to note that I do not agree, actually, that you would have to moderate consumption in the United States in order to have sustainable meat production because of what I talked about earlier. There's actually very good analyses that have been done showing that you could have all of the cattle that are raised in the United States today on grass, and you'd have plenty of land to do it. And as far as the other resources that are impacted, I argue in my book that when grazing is well managed, you actually have positive impacts on the total water issue with both quality and quantity in the food system, and that it enhances the biodiversity in terms of in the soils, in the vegetation, and in wildlife. So I don't really totally agree with what that statement that caller was saying about how meat is inherently bad. That's a lot of what I'm arguing against in this book, actually.
And let's go to more of your calls. Let's go to Judith in Davis.
Yes, my question partly was brought up by somebody in terms of grass. We're being asked as a community all throughout California to plant native grasses, take out our grass in our lawns, in our homes. But what about the fact that there was native grass and now it's been replaced. You keep talking about all the land that the cattle use that couldn't be used. I'm questioning, what about the native plants that were there in the first place?
Well, California has been in much of it in grassland for millions of years. I actually base a lot of the research in my book on a wonderful textbook that is used at UC Berkeley called California Grasslands, rather. And it talks about how going way back to prehistoric times, there were very vast stretches of grasslands throughout the United States and especially in California. And in fact, those megafauna, those big animals that I was talking about that maintained grasslands and created the grasslands and all of the life that exists in those, including what's there today over an evolutionary period. Those in California, we had 18 of those megafauna. So we had two different kinds of elephants. We had two different kinds of camels. We had lions. We had, you know, many large grazing animals and a bison, et cetera. And we had predators that kept them moving and kept them densely congregated, which is how you maintain grasslands. So actually, grasslands have always been a very, very important part of the ecosystems of the Americas and especially in California. I do agree that native grasses are probably optimal. I think the caller suggested that. There's actually some really interesting research that's been done at the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, suggesting that even carbon sequestration is better when you're using the native grasslands. So I think that to the extent possible, we want to support native grasslands. There's pretty good evidence that grazing actually helps reestablish, especially when it's properly managed, is really helpful to reestablishing native grasses.
And we're getting some more comments, some challenges, best tweets. Listening to Nicolette Hahn-Nyman defending beef, my man says, I'm going to write a book on how SUVs are good for the earth. Another listener writes, I practice vegetarianism for moral reasons and health is a minor consideration, as I hope is the case with other vegetarians and vegans. To take the life of another living animal for food is not something my conscience can rationalize. A farmer named Benjamin asks, can you talk for a moment about tall grass grazing and Alan Savory's holistic management practices? This is something that you practice on your ranch, correct?
Yeah, well, to an extent. I mean, we don't do as much. We're not as strictly following Savory's practices as I would like, and I really want to move our ranch more in that direction. It's actually something we're in discussion with right now with the National Park Service because they actually are in control of the land that we graze. We have a life estate on the land. But basically, I talk a lot about Alan Savory in the book because he, to me, is one of the most important figures in this whole question of the world's grasslands and how do we, you know, what is their importance and how do we optimally preserve those. And he argues that, you know, his background is as a wildlife ecologist. He's not a rancher. And he's been working on grasslands and land restoration for several decades now all over the world. And he believes, you know, he's a primary proponent of this idea that the world once was covered with enormous grazing animals, and there were millions, tens of millions of years of evolution that took place under those conditions, and that you cannot restore ecosystems without the presence of these large grazing animals. And as he says, there are just a few ways to have comparable impacts to these large grazing animals, and domesticated animals, he thinks, are by far the best way.
And let's go to more of your calls. Let's go to Nathan in Berkeley. Hi, Nathan.
Hi, how's it going?
Great. Do you have
Excellent.
A question?
Yeah, I was curious. So I just want to preface this. I totally don't support the way that milk is produced on a large scale across this country, you know, from cows. And I'm wondering, you know, I completely support, you know, going back to, you know, using cattle and farming and so on and so forth. But I'm wondering, you know, why not, you know, live with the cow and actually, you know, get the milk from the cow over its entire lifespan, which can be just as, if not more nutritious, easier to digest in fats. And, you know, a lot of people wouldn't have to deal with the whole moral thing of actually killing the cow for the meat to get the protein and so on and so forth.
Nathan, thanks. Nicolette Hahn-Nyman, you actually write about this a little bit in your book, but you also write about how you feel like cows are killed quite young.
Well, in the I think what the caller was referring to is the sort of – and actually I talked a lot about this, the dairy industry, my first book, Righteous Pork Chop. But basically, modern dairy cows have been taken off the grass and they're contained, especially in California. Actually, California, the vast majority of the dairy industry is large confinement, total confinement operations. And they may have just a little dry lot to go out onto, but they're almost never on grass once they reach maturity. So I would agree with the idea that that is not a sustainable or humane way to produce dairy products. And actually, the most largest number of cattle anywhere in the world are in India. And they're actually kind of the way the caller was describing. They're used for dairy, although those cattle are ultimately slaughtered and shipped mostly outside of the country to be eaten as meat. So it's not, you know, exactly the way he envisioned it. But basically, I think that it's really important that animals be back on grass as much as possible. I'm very strongly opposed to having animals in continual confinement.
Thanks, Nathan, for the call. A listener writes, meat consumption is declining in this country, but it is still much higher than meat consumption in the third world. It is true that as the third world eats more meat, they're now having health issues that did not exist before, such as heart disease and diabetes. What does your guest think has happened?
Well, there's the whole second half of my book, actually, is about health and nutrition. And I trace the whole sort of the epidemiological research and all of the thinking that's been happening over the last few decades from both the public health and the medical community. There's a very large body of evidence that now supports the conclusion that that rise that actually began to happen in the United States and other westernized countries about the middle of the 20th century is not due to saturated fats, but is due to other components, things that are more present in modern day diets, and primarily sugar and other refined carbohydrates. In fact, I was just reading an article. There's a ton of research that's been done on this. In fact, the UCSF Medical Center has a lot of the researchers and physicians that are working on advocating this idea worldwide that we really need to shift our focus to sugar and away from fats because that they really have not been shown to be the culprit they were once believed to be.
And let's go to Joan in San Jose. Hi, Joan.
Hi. Yes, a number of years ago, the idea that grazing animals, including wildlife, would destroy the soils and the grasses, a very erroneous idea. It was the absolute opposite that's true. And there was a wildlife ecologist in Africa who felt that the elephant herds were destroying the soils and trampling the grasses, and he now admits that he was completely wrong. He, under his direction, 40,000 elephants were massacred in Africa to protect the grasses, and, of course, everything got worse after they were gone. And this is, like, much more than perhaps was done by the ivory traders. So scientists, when they get going and don't really know what they're talking about, can cause great damage. And I think you're absolutely right on the government being responsible for the chemicals being used and the large chemical companies too. The genetically modified things, these are all political, and so is the use of wartime chemicals in agriculture. And it needs to be changed, and the funding needs to change. In Canada, they use ranches as a buffer, as an ecological buffer for the national parks. For example, Waterton National Park. In San Jose, the Open Space Authority, which just passed Measure Q, one of their main focuses is on well-managed agricultural land, and it's because it provides a safety around the open space and the wilderness areas we want to preserve.
Joan, thanks for the call. And this is actually something you touch on as well, this actual incident related to
the
elephants.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting the caller was actually talking about Alan Savory. He's the exact ecologist that we were talking about earlier in the program. He tells that story himself. He bought into the belief that was being taught and largely still is being taught in a lot of the ecological programs around the world that grazing animals and all larger animals have detrimental effects on the ecosystems. And his practical experience began to show him otherwise. And he's now become sort of the world's leading proponent for sustainable grazing. I also want to agree very strongly with the caller's comment about the importance of ranches for preserving open space, especially in urban fringe areas. I attended a round table at Stanford University on rangelands a couple of years ago, and all of the scientists in the room were in complete agreement that preserving rangeland in California is incredibly important because it provides so many ecological benefits. There are rangelands all over the state that are being developed, basically, as strip malls and housing, et cetera. And this is a huge ecological problem. Among other things, they provide a tremendous amount of habitat for wild animals, including pollinators. And Berkeley has actually, UC Berkeley has done a study showing that as much as 30% to 40% of the crop pollination takes place from wild pollinators, most of whom live on rangelands. So it's a very important part of the landscape that we really need to preserve.
Thanks, Joan. And this reminds me of sort of all the other intangibles that you, or more intangible, that you mentioned in your book about the benefits of grass-based meat production. And one of those being is just even living on a ranch. You see it in your own boys, how humans can be more connected to the land this way.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really important part of this issue, although it gets rarely discussed. Only about 17% of Americans live in rural areas today. The vast majority of Americans live in suburbs and cities. And I think that that's had really tangible effects as far as our understanding of nature and how it functions. And in fact, I worry very much about that as far as overall environmental protection that takes place in this country. Because historically, the vast majority of the naturalists that have done so much of the, you know, incredibly, everybody from, you know, Wendell Berry and Aldo Leopold and people, you know, you can, Beatrix Potter. I mean, people who were on farms or who lived on farms or grew up on farms had a great deal of access to nature and understood how it functioned and valued it. And I think we need citizens doing that.
One last thought from a listener. The thing to remember in these discussions of diet, food, and climate is that diversification and moderation are key. The trend should be towards smaller and more diverse food systems rather than industrial monocultures. Of course, you can't feed the world with grass-fed beef, but a sustainable middle ground is possible and necessary. Nicolette Hahn-Nyman, thanks so much for talking to us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Her new book is Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Danny Bringer and Jim Bennett. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Mina Kim. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.